Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones. Now Charlotte, before we get underway, like me, did you get forwarded the New Yorker article about the superyacht industry by about 1,000 different people the other day?
I did. I woke up and I had messages on Teams, on my inbox, on LinkedIn, people that don't even know about superyachts, but it was a good piece.
Yeah, I quite liked it. It's not too bad, actually. It certainly painted a picture. It was quite colourful. There were some really choice quotes that I thought I'd pick out. I like this line, a giga yacht. They insist on using this word giga yacht. I'm not a fan of this giga yacht term at all. It's super yachts is the catch-all, not giga yacht. Anyway, one of the lines was, a giga yacht is the most expensive item that our species has figured out how to own. It's about right. Bill Duca, meanwhile, former owner of Sybaris and Rasselas and current WSA judge, said if the rest of the world learns what it's like to live on a yacht like this, they're going to bring back the guillotine.
I love those more candid quotes. Bill Duca always gives great quotes, I think. And I know what he means.
Bill does give great quotes, you're right. So how about this one? One anonymous owner quoted in the piece said, no one today, except for assholes and ridiculous people, lives on land in what you would call a deep and broad luxe life. Yes, people have nice houses and all of that, but it's unlikely that the ratio of staff to them is what it is on a boat. Boats are the last place that I think you can get away with it.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. They were kind of saying in the piece that, you know, if you have, as houses get bigger and bigger and more expensive, they kind of get a bit more inhospitable, like you start rattling around in them. Whereas with boats, you know, the more money you spend on them, just the better places they become to be, essentially. And I thought that rung quite true from the ones I've seen anyway. They can easily absorb a lot of capital, as lots of owners will be aware.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And like that kind of, it is the best service ever you'll ever experience in any form of luxury experience being on a superyacht. Rings true, that quote. But annoyingly, irritatingly, the article described us, Boat International, as a glossy trade magazine. Glossy, I'll take glossy, but trade? Terrible.
I am personally disgusted as well. Trade. I've never been associated with trade. That's just awful. Especially because they used our research throughout, you know, all these references to cryo spas and medical facilities and stuff. They was all lifted from articles that the hardworking team at luxury magazine Boat International have been slaving away on. And actually, I thought I'd mention Captain Brendan O'Shaughnessy, who's quoted quite extensively throughout and gave quite a good interview. We had him on the pod not that long ago, so I'll link that that episode down below for this one if anyone's interested in having a listen. But yeah, in all, I thought it was a really good magazine. It did a very good job of painting the scene to people that aren't in this world. It was accurate, I thought.
Yeah. And we need to get Bill Duca on the podcast, don't we, as well, because he is eminently quotable.
Yeah, definitely.
It'd be a good interview. In other Boat International glossy, very non-trade magazine news, we've just put the Superyachts book to press. So anyone familiar with us and the work we do will know that every year we produce this, frankly, stunning coffee table book, which features kind of all the biggest and best yacht reports from the last 12 months, as well as an essay on a particular aspect of superyacht design or innovation or something like that. This year, it's all about how design is changing to reflect the fact that people are spending a lot longer on their boats, chartering for longer, working from their boats much more than before. That was done by Kate Lardy, who did a fantastic job. So that'll launch at the Monaco Yacht Show. We'll have copies there. It's a very, very special edition, kind of the first big bounce back post-COVID super yachts book. But the fact that we're even talking about the Monaco Yacht Show fills me with anxiety. It seems to come around quicker every year. If I have this conversation every year at this time, I think, how are we talking about Monaco already?
It does. Well, we've all booked our flights. We're all ready and raring to go. Booked the gone through the impossible accommodation hurdles that come up every year to get all the boat team out there. But yeah, I'm excited to see superyachts. It's just a great way of looking back at, you know, the past 12 months, you know, amazing launches and that sort of thing, and having them all in one place.
And there's some brilliant boats in there this year. Obviously, we've got Arpo, which is the cover star of our very recent August issue. Octopus is in there, Al Wahb, C, Club M, you know, a bunch of fairly fantastic super yachts that have been very recently delivered to their very lucky owners. So don't miss out on the Super Yachts book. That'll be with you for sale in the next couple of months. It's a brilliant one.
I can't wait to have a look at that. It's just the best of the best, isn't it? But you're off again. Where are you off to next week?
It's Saudi Arabia next week. We're going to visit NEOM again. So I was out in Saudi towards the end of last year to see NEOM, this quite almost science fiction-y area of the Red Sea coast of Saudi Arabia, where they're going to build mega cities and vast resorts. And the scale of it is just slightly difficult to comprehend. But it's all part of a Vision 2030 for the country, really developing that Red Sea tourism, luxury tourism industry. So we're going to go have another little look, because we're doing some work with those guys out there, and we're flying into Riyadh before heading over to the NEOM region. So I just checked the weather. It'll be mid-40s Celsius. So well over 100 Fahrenheit. I know what you're thinking, Charlotte. Why is a balding, pale redhead with a very poor record of tanning going to the hottest place on earth in the middle of its summer? Just a unfortunate coincidence, sadly. It's just the best opportunity. If I survive, I'll report back on my findings from the Red Sea soon.
I have to say, now you mention it, I don't think I ever have seen you tanned. Not like properly tanned, which is bizarre because you're always in the hottest countries in the world. It's quite interesting seeing the comparison between you and our CEO, Toby Moore, because quite often you go to the same places and he comes back sort of a rich mahogany and you stay kind of similar. But I have a top tip for you from my time, you know, years and years ago, I used to do beauty writing, and a top tip for going to hot places: Japanese sunscreen is the best sunscreen you can get. I've just restocked up. Much better than French, much better than, you know, your Ocean Potion and all those American ones. You want to get some Japanese sunscreen on Amazon, it will see you through.
Why is Japanese sunscreen so good?
I'll send you a link. They're advanced. They're very, very lightweight. They really work. I've done tests on the beach with Japanese on one side and others on the other. It always works. Always works.
Wow. Who knew? I'll
send you a link. Yeah.
Well, I grew up in Australia, as you know. So in the age of slip, slap, slop. And it was slip on a t-shirt, slap on some sun, slop on a hat, slap on some sun cream. I think that was it. So basically, when my generation growing up in Australia, because my parents' generation, we're all sat down to the beach with no sun cream on, and they're all now having kind of skin cancers burnt off their faces. My parents are constantly in the clinics getting various skin cancers burnt off them. But my generation grew up and it was militant. You had to wear sun cream and a hat constantly. So I'm very, it stayed with me.
I had the same, but growing up in rural Essex in the UK, I think sometimes I was coated in about an inch of sunscreen that was entirely unnecessary. But there you go. I have to say, Monaco, every time I go to Monaco, I feel like, I swear, it has its own microclimate there. Every time I'll just be standing outside the Monaco Yacht Show, and within about half an hour, I feel like I'm burning up. Whatever time of year, whatever the weather forecast says, it's always roasting there. If I ever have the time, I'll do an experiment on that.
With your Japanese sun cream.
With my Japanese sun cream. Actually, to be fair, the Japanese sunscreen always protects me, but it's a close run thing in Monaco. It's too hot there.
It is. It does feel burning in Monaco. It does. The sun feels very powerful there.
Always.
Yeah. Yeah. I always have lots of sun cream on in Monaco.
Well, I spoke to two very tanned people this week, tanned and kind of sickeningly good looking, I have to say. I interviewed the Turner twins, who you might have heard of. They've been in and out of the press. Basically, they are twins, as you can imagine, and they do a huge load of adventuring. They just did their second kind of marine adventure, but they've done all sorts of things together. And I kind of spoke to them where they were reclining on a yacht in a marina in A Coruña in Spain. And they started traveling together when one of them had a really serious diving accident and broke his neck sort of around the time they're at university, which meant he couldn't do the kind of competitive contact sport that he liked doing. So the two of them together began exploring. And I spoke to them for Boat Briefing for this podcast. So they'll be on Monday if you want to have a listen to that interview, because they've been on this sort of 6-week, 100% emission-free sailing expedition to the Atlantic Pole of Inaccessibility.
What
which I think is
on
what,
earth is
that? I know. So I asked that. It's their term. They came up with it. But it's basically the geographic location furthest from any coast is what it is. If you're listening to this thinking, what the hell is that? But they did actually, they've had a few issues with the mission, so it's not quite successful yet, but they'll go into that on the pod. But the point of it was that they were kind of testing out a whole load of sustainable solutions with this yacht, which, like I said, is completely emissions free, and also doing some scientific research. They deployed a buoy off the back of it. They were doing stuff with a satellite. And it's the first time I've ever got excited by an anti-fouling product, I have to say. They were telling me about, it's not the sexiest sounding thing, but they were telling me about this kind of product, which you might have heard of, I never had, which has been around for a couple of years and hasn't taken off. That's basically like a big carpet that you stick on the underside of the boat. And they say it kind of works like a sea urchin. So if you do get any debris, you just kind of brush it off and keeps your boat completely clean. And it saves all those toxic anti-fouling products washing into the sea, which I'm obviously a big fan of.
Carpet. Does it mean like not like a rough? I mean, that would defeat the purpose, really. You need a hull to be as smooth as it possibly.
No, no, not like a kind of Austin Powers shag like rug. like it's essentially something you stick on the boat. But the way that we're trying to describe it is, it's like a carpet. It's a kind of fabric that traps stuff within it, and then you just brush the stuff out, like a sea urchin skin. It made sense when they described it.
I mean, if it's successful, fantastic, because you know, anti-fouling is not a nice product generally. Obviously, it's quite poisonous. So, if there's a greener alternative, that's fantastic.
Yeah, they said it worked a treat. But I realized as I was interviewing them, well, I realized two things. The first is I realized I've actually seen them before, because they've been working with, there's a university in London that does research, kind of global research on twins. And they did this program on the BBC years ago where one of them went vegan for a while and one of them didn't, and they both did the exact same training and they went mountaineering, and the one who had been on the vegan diet performed better. And it's so interesting seeing how people who are kind of genetically identical, they're identical twins, I think. And he was saying, you know, one of them performs really well at altitude, one of them really struggles with the heat. And technically, their kind of body makeup is the same. So that's quite interesting. But I did realize as I was recording the interview that, of course, their voices are absolutely identical. So whereas normally when you interview two people, it's clear who's speaking, it sometimes wasn't that clear. So I did my best to try and direct questions at different ones. But I think at times they're perhaps interchangeable. But yeah, you can listen to that. That's out on Monday.
So that transcribing that interview would be an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're just the twins. I'm just going to do it as one. They're the Turner twins. They speak as one voice. So yeah, there's that. And then just been doing a lot of features for our big October issue. Speaking of Monaco, that's our bumper issue that comes out every year there and is jam-packed with good stuff. And I wanted to highlight one of the features. We've been calling it pool porn. I think that's probably too rude for the mag. I think I've changed it to something like cool pools recently, but it is essentially pool porn. It's just really beautiful pictures of amazing, high-tech, super cool pools on yachts that you've probably not seen before. And there are some amazing ones. There's the 67 Custom Benetti Sea Sense. That's got a 10-meter swimming pool on the aft deck and a kind of misting system that keeps the heat at bay, which I thought was very cool. And then that can be transformed into a basketball court with baskets. Probably less for me. I'd probably just stay with the pool. But, you know, cool that it can transform.
Sea Sense is a great party platform, the back of that boat. It's got a massive aft deck. It was at Monaco a few years ago. And it reminded me of a resort pool almost, because all around the edge you can actually sit, or you know, quite a few people can be lying on sun lounges. It's a really, really good kind of just relaxing entertainment deck.
A good you do look at it and you just want to get on a lounger and hang around by the pool. It's got that
with lots of Japanese sun cream on.
With lots of Japanese sun cream and a parasol, but you know, you still want to be there. And then we had Tatiana, which is this kind of 80-meter that's got two huge pools. And the pictures of this are amazing because it's got one in the sort of sea level beach club, which goes both indoors and out. It kind of runs the length of it. And then there's a second one directly above it that has skylights across the bottom. And this creates this amazing sort of dappled lighting effects in the water below. So that looks very cool. And that does look very party. There's some pictures of people kind of in the water, and it looks like somewhere where you would have a couple of cocktails with a DJ out on deck. And you know, it looks like lots of fun, basically.
I always think with those pools, though, if you're swimming around in the pool above and people are below staring up at you into the pool, it's never the most flattering view.
They don't, though. Everyone's having too good a time. They're all staring at each other on their level. They're not staring up at your feet.
Who is that whale? Who is that pale whale swimming above?
I know where you're coming from. You'd want to be in the bottom pool. You just have to pick your pool carefully.
Yeah, I don't want people having that view of me. That's not a good view.
You'll just do backstroke, maybe. And then there was Illusion Plus, which is a big boat, 88.5 meters, which is apparently the largest motor yacht built in Asia. And that has two jacuzzis, and one has a kind of luxury waterfall coming out of it. That's pretty cool. And then there was one concept, which I just thought was so awesome when I saw the pictures. I know it's a concept, but it's really, really, really cool. This is the Tankoa T760 Apache, 57 meters, designed by Alberto Mancini. And this has got the swimming pool suspended in the bow, kind of between the upper and the main deck. And it looks amazing. It looks like it's floating. It looks like some space age thing. It's got a glass bottom, so it literally looks kind of invisible, and the light floods down from there into the lounge and the gym. And yeah, it's just really worth it. It's if you're looking for ideas for your next pool, because there's no doubt that they're becoming a bigger and bigger thing, and having a great beach club is also becoming a big thing, definitely check it out, because there were some amazing pics in there and lots of good ideas.
It sounds like an aquarium.
It does. It looks really, it's kind of the defining feature of the boat. When you look at it, you just see this big, amazing pool. But yeah, I would love to see that made a reality, because it's awesome.
All righty. Let's talk news. Why don't you kick us off, Charlotte?
Sure. So our first story is that ISA Yachts has announced the sale of a new 80-meter custom super yacht. The unnamed project marks the first collaboration between the Italian shipyard and Espinoino, who is responsible for the yacht's exterior design. It will be the largest yacht built to date by ISA Yachts and is slated for delivery in 2026, so not that long to wait, really. Giuseppe Palumbo, the director of Palumbo Superyachts, has described it as an avant-garde project that consolidates the company's presence in the international superyacht panorama. Meanwhile, Espin said, "We are delighted to be working with ISA on this exciting project. The owners are experienced and have a keen eye for aesthetics and a background in naval architecture."
So this is the biggest boat ISA will have built. I think it pips Resilience by a few meters. And it's interesting looking thing. Well, ish. I mean, it's very hard to tell, because often these concepts, there's obviously some fairly firm NDAs in place. So the picture is basically just a few lines on a drawing. It's very enigmatic. And it hints at what it might look like when it eventually comes out. So it's equally enigmatic and frustrating, because you just kind of have to use your imagination a little bit. But a huge project for ISA. So massive congratulations to them and Palumbo Superyachts, which obviously owns the brand.
Yeah, I like the sound of it. It sounds unusual. Speaking of interesting new projects, our next news story is that highly secretive 103-meter FedShip superyacht project, known only as FedShip 1011, has had its technical launch. The vessel is now on its way to the FedShip shipyard in Macomb, where she'll complete outfitting ahead of her 2024 delivery date. Her exterior design is the work of Dutch studio Sino Yacht Architecture and Design, and features a striking vertical bow. The project's the fourth largest FedShip ever to be built, following the 118-meter FedShip 821 and FedShip 1010. Both are currently also in build at the shipyard, and the 110-meter Anna. So a big boat, a big secret boat.
Big secret boat. But with this one, at least, you can kind of get a much better idea of what it will finally look like. And I really like the look of this boat. That bow is very, very cool. And it's... I don't know if geometric's the right word, but it's just got a really together-looking profile, this boat. I think Sino do such a fantastic job. 2024. So we don't have to wait too long before we see her complete delivered on the water.
I love FedShip. I'm very excited to see that.
Yeah. Last up this week, we have the very good news that Fiji has altered its regulations for charter yachts operating in Fijian waters. So the changes were implemented to the Super Yacht Charter Act in order to allow more yachts to benefit from the region's up-and-coming maritime tourism industry. So under the new regulations, yachts measuring 18 meters or more with a charter rate starting at $30,000 per week are able to obtain a superyacht charter license. In the past, yachts had to measure in excess of 24 meters and have a charter rate starting at $55,000 to benefit from the license. So it's just opening the market a little bit more to smaller and lesser, not so expensive yachts. The move should see a lot more foreign flagged yachts made available for charter in Fiji and follows other moves to further liberalise the cruising market in the South Pacific. Earlier in May, the New Zealand Marine Industry Association announced that updated yachting regulations will finally come into play from August. The new regulations were agreed upon by the four major yachting hubs of the South Pacific Sea 2 years ago, but obviously COVID scuppered their implementation. But they're finally now happening. And the new regulations will allow foreign flagged superyachts to cruise each country's waters for a minimum of 2 years on a revolving basis under a new temporary import entry rules. Australia, Fiji, French Polynesia and New Zealand coordinated to introduce the new rules, and they will come into force following the final easing of pandemic-related restrictions very, very soon. All four countries are open to foreign flag chartering too, with Tahiti announcing an extended cruising allowance for up to 60 months. Meanwhile, yachts visiting Australia can also apply for an extension of their stay after 2 years.
Wow, big news then.
Really big news. And it's interesting. Look, for the longest time, it was a huge frustration to people. Because one of the reasons people didn't go to the South Pacific, because it obviously costs a fortune to take your boat there. And you don't, it's not like you go there. Often people don't go there and spend months on their boat. They might want to go there, spend a couple of weeks on board, then come back. But then obviously the boat's on the other side of the world. And if it's there, it'd be great if you could earn an income if you're not using it. And charter rules had previously made it quite tricky. So now this will help owners make that decision to get their boats into the South Pacific because they know when they're there and they're not on board, at least they can have it chartered. And they're not being kicked out of various territories before too long. So altogether, it's wrap, you know, it all adds up to very, very good news for the South Pacific superyacht scene. And I wanted to mention this story particularly because I was just talking to Irvin Laidlaw yesterday, actually. He's the owner of 67-meter Lady Christine, as many people will know. And he was mentioning French Polynesia because he spent some considerable time there on his boat last year. So his recommendation was to spend at least 4 weeks visiting the three groups of islands. He loved Maria and the Tuamotus and advised owners not to skip the Marquesas. Often people do, of course, because they tend to travel over to the Galapagos, spend some time there. Then owners will often leave the boat and the crew will do the passage across to the Marquesas, which takes about, you know, 20 odd days. It's a couple of thousand miles and the owner's often not on board. So then the owner will fly back to meet the boat in Tahiti, which is obviously beyond the Marquesas. So that little cool little island chain is often skipped over because when the owner's in French Polynesia or Tahiti, the thought of going backwards to the Marquesas isn't always on the top of their list. But Lord Laidlaw reckons you should make the effort. And coming from someone who has cruised as widely as him, I mean, he's really done it all. The advice is worth taking.
I've heard good things about the Marquesas as well. Everyone I speak to that's been to that part of the world, it's always kind of top on their list. So that, you know, it must be as incredible a place as people say, because it's always something that comes up as one of the kind of highlights of that trip and that part of the world.
Well, it's interesting because in Cecile interviewed Bob Giles, the owner of Viviray, the Nordhavn, in a very recent podcast. I recommend everyone listen to that because it's a really good one. So Bob's done a lot of cruising too, and he skipped the Marquesas for this very reason because he, mm-hmm. I think he left the boat in the Galapagos, went home. I think he's from Louisiana and then flew back to join the boat when it was in Tahiti. So he skipped the Marquesas. I can completely understand why owners do it, because once you're kind of going in that direction, it kind of makes more sense to keep going in the right direction towards New Zealand and Australia. But if you listen to Lord Laidlaw, which I suggest is a good idea, just head back a bit. Go check out the Marquesas. Don't skip them.
Goes with my theory that the more of a pain in the ass somewhere is to get to, the more it's worth going. I genuinely believe that. Like, the more, if you're looking at a journey that you think, God, that's going to take me forever, what a pain in the ass, is definitely going to be worth your while. And if it's a quick flight, it's, yeah, just average.
His other advice was, and this doesn't obviously apply to all boats, was take a helicopter.
Okay, I will.
If your boat's got a heli, makes the world of difference. He also had a few interesting things to say about catamarans. He's building a new gunboat 80. He's firmly in the multi-hull, on the side of the multi-hull.
Camp Catamaran.
Yeah, Camp Catamaran. Another one. Another one on side.
We'll have more on that next week, where we'll kind of pull out some bits from this big catamaran special we've got coming up, and we'll have catamarans data. So you finally succeeded in catamaran domination for next week's episode.
Excellent. Well, that's next week's data. Let's talk about data this week. What's it all about, Charlotte?
Well, so this week's data, as ever, brought to you by our market intelligence platform, Boat Pro, is a niche. This week, we're looking at niche stuff. So you might think that semi-custom boats under 40 meters are always made of composite, but that's not the case. So this week, we're taking a look at ones that are built with a steel or an aluminium hull. And you know that because it was your idea.
Yeah, full disclosure. So this was actually prompted by a request I made to our data guru, Raphael, the other day. So I was writing up our cover feature, which everyone will be relieved to find out is finally finished after production team threw various things at my head. I finally knuckled down and got it done. The cover feature is obviously about the Beyond 37 from Bonetti. When I was writing it, because my instinct was that there wasn't a lot of other sub 40 meter semi-custom steel hulled boats in the market. So I wanted to check that with Raphael. But before that, I'd actually proclaimed on the podcast that there weren't that many semi-custom steel hulled sub 40 meter boats around. Well, what did I learn? Don't make stupid proclamations like that until I've checked with Raphael, because it actually turns out there's more than I thought. So, with that mea culpa in mind, Charlotte, why don't we talk numbers?
Well, I can see why you thought that, because the proportion of steel-hulled boats under 40 metres is definitely on a downward trend. It's not exactly booming up at the moment. So, in the 70s, about 35% of all sub-40-metre semi-custom boats were built with steel, and that number since 2020 is just 2.4%. So, there has been a pretty rapid decline there. Of the 782 semi-custom boats under 40 metres delivered since 2020, just 19 were built in steel. So 19 out of 782. But there's hope for the future. The downward trend could be reversed, because there are some very successful series being launched in this market, all packing steel or aluminium hulls. So to give a sense of where we are now, in today's order book of sub 40 meter semi-custom yachts, there are 38 steel projects and 17 aluminium hulled ones. And more importantly, I think there's some pretty cool recent examples that might kind of set the trend going forward. So there's the Bonetti Beyond, first hull just launched, and that's an Explorer series built in steel. There's the Moon in Martinique. Hull 4 is going to be delivered early 2023, and that's another steel hull. The Numarine 37 XP, Hull 2's just been delivered of that, and that's another steel hull. And then the Arxen 85, which we're looking forward to getting a look at shortly. The first hull of that is due to be delivered this year. I think they're unveiling it at Metz, actually. And the hull is aluminium for that one. So some very cool trailblazers there. And it'll be interesting to see if they manage to kind of set the trend, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's some great series there. And a few other mentions too. You know, Rossetti builds in steel, Choi Lee, Cantiere della Marche. Bearing Yachts are coming out with some cool new series. Alia, Arva Yachts. Way more than I thought originally. So it's interesting. And what Paolo Vitelli says, or told me when I went out to see the boat, was that this is what owners are really looking for, that permanence now. And steel certainly gives you that. That's why he really, really pushed for steel for the 37 meter Beyond. And he said when he first kind of pitched the idea to the Bonetti board of directors, they weren't The whole concept wasn't received with much enthusiasm by the board, he said. You know, even though he owns the shipyard, he's still going to get all the bright ideas past the committee. And they weren't really on board. So he really had to push for it. And now he's been utterly vindicated because they've sold 9 of them and they'll sell a bundle more. And some of these other, I mean, the New Marine 37XP, wildly successful series. The Move to Moon and Martinique, very successful. So, we'll definitely see more and more of these sub 40 meter steel hulled semi-custom boats coming out in the future. So when we do this again in a couple of years, that proportion of 2.4% should be, much bigger.
Well, Raphael pointed out as well, that despite, you know, you're saying owners are looking for permanence, but they're also a slightly kind of greener choice in terms of what happens with the yacht's end of life, because it's much easier to recycle, dispose of whatever you want to do, steel and aluminium, than it is composite, which is obviously notoriously difficult to get rid of. So it would be good to see things in going in that direction, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And generally, people are slowing down nowadays. They want more stability, slower, you know, longer range, slightly slower pace of life, more volume, which lends itself to, you know, metal construction generally. So interesting to look at, very, very niche, like you said. But, you know, often when you turn over these rocks, you don't know what you'll find. And I certainly was surprised by just how active this particular tiny segment of the market is. Well, not longer tiny anymore, really. I mean, it's going to get bigger and bigger. So that brings us to an end of this week's Boat Briefing podcast. Thank you, Charlotte.
Thank you very much. It's been a good week. See you. You can listen to the Turner Twins on Monday.
Yeah, definitely tune in for that one. And I'll return boat from a crisp to Saudi Arabia to tell you all about that trip.
I'm going to send you the sunscreen link now so you can put this to the test.
I can Amazon Prime some Japanese sunscreen before.
You can. Okay. Be your watery essence. It'll save you.
Thank you. This episode of Boat Briefing was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and have a great weekend. We'll see you all soon.